Michael McCambridge is with us on Sports Byline. The name of this book is called Lamar Hunt, A Life in Sports. Boy, I tell you, some of the great stories coming out of those early days of the AFL, stories like the New York Jets where the players were afraid that the checks that they were getting were not going to be good. So right after practice and they got their checks, they go right down to the bank in their uniform and their cleats trying to cash them. There were a lot of stories like that. Tell me what those early days were like, Michael.
Well, I think it was as you described. The New York Titans were sort of a fly by night outfit before Sonny Werblin rescued the team out of bankruptcy and renamed them the Jets and moved them to Shea Stadium and signed Joe Namath. But in those early years, it was really a touch and go operation. You know, the Denver Broncos were using old military Quonset huts for their training facilities. The Oakland Raiders were underfinanced, and it was a real question from year to year whether those teams were going to make it. But I go back again to the joint TV deal that gave the teams enough of a financial stake that they were able to inch along. And when the Titans became the Jets and were rescued, and then the Texans moved to Kansas City and became the Chiefs, you had two of the weakest financially performing franchises suddenly becoming two of the strongest financially performing franchises. And a year later, the AFL signs a five-year TV deal with NBC, and that was the deal truly that meant the AFL was there to stay. Or as the Pittsburgh Steelers owner Art Rooney put it at the time, they don't have to call us Mr. anymore.
Take me back to 1966 when the two leagues finally decided to merge, and he was part of the force that helped that come about.
Yeah, I think that was also a crucial part that Lamar played. You know, the negotiator on the other side was Tex Schramm, the president, general manager of the Dallas Cowboys, and Schramm really disliked the AFL, was not much of a fan of Lamar because he'd competed toe-to-toe with him for 3 years in Dallas. You know, when Schramm talked about the war in the 60s, he was not referring to Vietnam. It was serious business, the battle between the AFL and the NFL. And during that summer of 66, you truly needed somebody who was going to be calm, who was not going to lose his head. And Lamar coolly negotiated that while there were all sorts of other things going on. The New York Giants signing a veteran player from the AFL, the kicker Pete Gogolak, which escalated hostilities, and then Al Davis taking over as the commissioner of the AFL and beginning this guerrilla war to sign quarterbacks away from the NFL franchises. And you really needed somebody to keep his eyes on the prize, and that was what Lamar did during that summer.
Was there a conscious effort to have a philosophical playing difference from the established NFL? Because as I looked at the AFL in those early days, they were wide open. They were gunslinging quarterbacks. They were fast and fleet-footed wide receivers, whereas the NFL was kind of a grinded-out type of league.
Well, the NFL was certainly influenced by Vince Lombardi and the Packers' dominance. The AFL was, I think, just wider open to begin with because it was a more entertaining game. The most influential coaches in the AFL were people like Stid Gilman and Hank Stram, who had these inventive offensive minds. And the other point that I think can't be ignored is the AFL was much more aggressive about recruiting African-American players. And they had some of the greatest athletes in pro football fairly early in the 60s. And that made a difference and allowed them to play a wider open game.
He came up with the name Super Bowl. Tell me about how he came up with it.
It was a month after the merger. It was July of 66. And Lamar was on this committee to work out the details of the merger. They knew they were going to play a game between the AFL and NFL after that season. But the two leagues wouldn't fully merge until 1970. So at the time, the name of the game was the AFL-NFL World Championship Game, which does not roll trippingly off the tongue. Lamar wrote a letter to Pete Rozelle that summer and said, I think we should come up with a catchy name for this game. I have jokingly called it the Super Bowl, but I am sure you can come up with something better than that. Rozelle was a real stickler about language, and he didn't like the term super. He thought it was over the top, and it was an example of hyperbole, so he resisted it. But as you know, it didn't matter, because as soon as it got out into the public sphere and media circles, that's what everybody started calling the game. The NFL sort of held its ground and insisted on calling it the AFL-NFL World Championship game for the first 2 years. And then finally, before Super Bowl III, Rozelle just threw up his hands and said, I guess it's a great name. We'll call it the Super Bowl.
You know, the other thing I always wondered about is after they merge, and of course the Jets' victory over the Baltimore Colts was the, I guess you might say, the opening salvo in getting accepted on parity with the established National Football League. But at what point did Lamar feel like he and his brothers in the old AFL were finally accepted as whole members in professional football?
Well, you know, I thought it was Super Bowl III as well, but when I wrote my previous book, America's Game, which was a book about how pro football eclipsed baseball to become the nation's most popular sport, and I went back and looked at magazines and newspapers of the time, the feeling after Super Bowl III was that it was a fluke, that if the Jets and Colts had played 10 times, the Colts were going to win 8 or 9 of those games. And going into the next Super Bowl, the fourth Super Bowl, the Vikings were like 16-point favorites over Lamar Hunt's Chiefs. And it was that game when the Chiefs completely manhandled the Vikings and won 23-7 that you started seeing stories in which people said, okay, that this other league truly is the equal of the NFL. And ironically, of course, the league finally got that respect at the very moment it ceased to exist and became fully absorbed into the NFL.
The sub-story to him being in Kansas City that I find fascinating, and you could probably help me with some understanding here, Michael, and that is, you know, after they moved the Dallas Cowboys into Dallas to try to snuff out the AFL, he did move the team then to Kansas City. And, you know, I always wondered about a guy that was rich, that was in a major market like Dallas, and then all of a sudden he goes to Kansas City, which is kind of the heartland of the country. He really did embrace that community, and the community embraced him. What was behind that acceptance of each other?
I think partly it was because Lamar was thrilled that he had a town to himself for his football team after, you know, slogging it out with the Cowboys for 3 years. But it was also Kansas City. It had such an unfortunate experience with owner Charlie Finley of the Kansas City Athletics. And, you know, Finley tried to move the team away from Kansas City about as soon as he moved them to Kansas City. And Lamar Hunt stayed and worked very hard to build a competitive team. And the other thing that Lamar said to me once was, in 1965, after the death of the Chiefs running back Mack Lee Hill, who died during routine knee surgery a couple days after one of their games, the city really rallied around. And despite all the rumors that the Chiefs might move, they finally began to believe that Lamar was there to stay. And the success of the Chiefs at the end of the 60s and the beginning of the 70s really helped put Kansas City on the map. And people today still talk about how exciting it was to be in Kansas City at that time, because the Chiefs meant something nationally.
The other thing I think that enhanced his time in Kansas City and being there, Michael, was the fact that he always believed in a connection with the fans. You could always find him out in the parking lot tailgating with the fans out there. I mean, he was an owner, he was a rich man, but he never came off that way. And I always felt in that country, or in that part of the country, that was one of the things that made him so successful.
Well, it was a common touch that is extremely rare, if not unique, among major professional sports owners. I have been around a lot of owners, and I've never met anyone quite like Lamar Hunt. And you're right, he would walk a big ring around Arrowhead Stadium a couple hours before games and meet fans tailgating and try out barbecues and see people set up. And he was always very gracious, and He was equally gracious and well-mannered to, you know, blue-collar fans as he was to fellow billionaires. And it was something that that is extremely rare in the world today, and it was then, too.
In about 20 seconds, was it harder for him to separate the personal as well as the professional, because it always seemed like he got caught up in the conflict between the two?
I think he was so geared to the fans' experience because he was still a fan. And so that was kind of, it was at that base level that he first noticed things. He would go around a stadium and take notes about concessions and ticket windows and stuff like that. That was what he was alert to, and it was what he understood.
We're going to take a break here, come back, and talk with Michael McCambridge about Lamar Hunt, the sportsman in other sports. We've got you on Sports Byline.